Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Helene Snee, who is a research associate at the University of Manchester, and we'll be discussing her new book, A Cosmopolitan Journey, Difference, Distinction, and Identity Work in Gap Year Travel, which is published by Ashgate this summer. Okay, hello. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we're going to be talking to Helene Snee, who is a research associate at the University of Manchester, about her new book, A Cosmopolitan Journey, Difference, Distinction, and Identity Work in Gap Year Travel. The book has just been published by Ashgate this summer, and it's a really interesting text that brings up all kinds of questions about culture, class, and the modern world in which we live. But to start with, it'd be really interesting to get a sense of why the book was written and where it kind of came from and Helene's intellectual journey behind the book. So if you could tell the listeners a little bit about that.
Okay, so I've always seen myself very much as a product of sociology at the University of Manchester. I initially took an undergraduate degree in economic and social sciences, so it's a bit more of a mixed social sciences degree when I started out during my undergraduate training. And it was really taking classes with people like Bev Skeggs and reading the work of people like Mike Savage and Alan Ward and Fiona Devine at Manchester that really kind of captured my imagination, particularly work that Drew and Bourdieu kind of really sparked a lot of intellectual questions for me. I didn't go straight on to do a master's degree when I finished my undergraduate degree. I took some time off, which mainly involved doing some rubbish kind of office jobs. But one of the things I did do was that I spent about 9 months travelling around Southeast Asia and Australia.
You did have a gap year then?
Yeah, well, this is it. This is where it all came from, really. And it wasn't... Well, the first thing is I never called it a gap year when I was doing it. That was something that I noticed on my return, that was kind of the way that people tended to frame it. I kind of very much saw it as travelling and taking some time out to travel. But yeah, that was definitely where the kind of the seeds were sown, really, for the book. So when I came back and I did a bit more kind of rubbish office jobs, and then applied to do my PhD at Manchester, which was based on, which is where this book came from. It's based on my PhD research.
I mean, it's really interesting because even in the kind of the language you're using there, you know, this idea of kind of travel, the question of whether it was called a gap year when you were sort of traveling and stuff like this is really, really important to the book.
And I think
that, you know, sort of terms we might focus on over the course of our discussion. But to start with, it'd be really useful actually if you could kind of explain what a gap year is and who are gappers, as you call them in the book, and maybe why do they matter?
Okay. I mean, a gap year is something that the definition that a lot of people use is kind of quite wide, which is any kind of the longest period of time that somebody will kind of take out of their normal trajectory, whether that be in education or employment. But because it can kind of be seen as something that people can do at any stage of their life. So you get this idea of silver gappers, which are people who are kind of a little bit older, they're taking some time out, maybe they've retired and they want to go and travel. Yet career gappers, where people have maybe established themselves in their career and they want to take a bit of time out again to travel. But I suppose the one kind of group of people it's most definitely associated is with young people taking some time off either between school and university or after they finish university like I did. And it's very much a sense of this is a kind of legitimate thing to do, that it's not just kind of bumming around, even though it might actually involve just bumming around. And it's what's really interesting that I found out recently is that that young people who are on gap years are counted and they're not in education, employment or training figures. because obviously they're not looking for work, they're not on any kind of official training schemes. But you would never consider a young person who's on a gap year as neat, because they don't fall into that problem category. So a lot of the book looks at the framing of particular types of experiences as legitimate. And I think that that's what interests me so much about gap years. As for the gappers themselves, particularly if we're talking about young people who are gappers, the very stereotypical kind of perception of a gapper as somebody who's quite posh, somebody who is kind of takes out his credit card and goes travelling around Southeast Asia and kind of gets into scrapes and isn't really that concerned about having a kind of proper experience. But even kind of poking fun at that kind of figure was something that was very interesting to me, that it kind of encapsulates and highlights some of the struggles that surround what is and isn't legitimate.
I mean, it's really interesting you talk about the kind of struggles for legitimacy, because the story you're telling about this social group is so like heavily classed, isn't it?
Yes.
And you know, it ties into really kind of particular elements of I guess kind of both British but kind of wider class structures. And I think maybe one sort of interesting way in which you tell this story in the book is the story of Max that you use in the mm-hmm. introduction. I don't know if you could tell the readers, the listeners, sort of Max's story and how both, you know, he seemed to be kind of critiqued from high and low social positions.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a bit of a gift, really. It's a great story to use, not just in the book, but using it in presenting this work. And basically, it's a young guy called Max Gogarty. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And The Guardian commissioned him to blog about his gap year. So he was going to India and Thailand. He was 19. And in some ways, it's kind of innocuous, kind of harmless, fun thing for him to do. So what happened to Max was that he wrote his first post, and it's very kind of tongue-in-cheek and playful, but in his description, his kind of biography, it does say that he writes for Skins in his spare time, which is quite a popular kind of young people television series. He's from North London. It turns out that his dad was a freelance journalist who'd also written for The Guardian. So there was a sense that this was somebody who was coming from a particular position of privilege, somebody who's kind of very much part of a kind of particular cultural class. So he writes this kind of very kind of funny blog post, and the response to it from the readers was just astounding. He just kind of gets everything ripped out of him. People attack him. They talk. The comments are great. They're calling him posh. He's just going away to get drunk. He's got money. But they also kind of pick up on a lot of the criticisms that have been levelled at gap years from an academic point of view as well. So he's going for life experiences on daddy's money. He's going to India to try and find himself. And that's kind of such a cliched thing to do, that it's kind of the commercialization of poverty, there's some way that's ennobling. It was a kind of a really interesting story, and his blog never went anywhere. Unfortunately, they pulled it. It made a few papers, I'm assuming he still went on his gap year, but yeah, the blog never happened. I think what Max's story shows is it really highlighted for me some of the three main themes that run throughout the book, which is the relationship between gappers and the people and the places that they come across, what young people actually get out of gap year travel, and how class plays a role in that, and the kind of this idea of gap year as a self-development as well, that a lot of the comments on the blog actually started to kind of pull that apart a little bit as well.
I mean, it's really interesting that you're really kind of keen to stress that, you know, the gappers, you know, the individuals that you're sort of working with were not, you know, the subject of criticisms, as it were. What you're trying to do is look both at the kind of, I suppose, the broader industry mm-hmm. that surrounds this practice, but also the kind of social structures in which they're embedded. And I guess a much broader kind of theoretical literature that is bound up with, I guess, making judgments about what is good and bad kind of behavior, taste, or cultural consumption practices. And one of the ways that I found really kind of fascinating in the book that you did this was by linking the practices of kind of going away or looking for authenticity or having one of these kind of gap adventures is through this idea of cosmopolitanism, which I think is really crucial and important in the book. So I wonder if you could sort of say what cosmopolitanism is, maybe give us an idea of the debates around it, and then kind of what role it plays in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about cosmopolitanism, I mean, is how kind of prevalent it's becoming in a lot of kind of social research and social theory at the moment. At the same time, it's something that's so kind of multifaceted and multidimensional and kind of even a contested term. So I think even the debates surrounding cosmopolitanism kind of are quite useful to play with and think about. I mean, at the very simple level, I've been looking at the idea of cosmopolitanism as being a world citizen, which is kind of very literally what the term means. So thinking about being awareness of yourself in a kind of global context, being open to difference and being tolerant of difference as well. But this also really overlaps with the kind of the moral and the ethical and political aspects of this as well. So not just looking at cosmopolitan as an orientation to the world, being open to difference, but how that might inform ideas about kind of political standpoints or kind of whether there is a kind of some kind of commonality, global kind of common culture, I suppose. So, yeah, really kind of this idea of becoming a citizen of the world, really, particularly in a concept in the kind of very well-established idea that, you know, globalisation is playing a bigger and bigger part in everybody's lives, and particularly for young people who might be looking to what they should be doing with their lives, and the idea of the global kind of features quite strongly in that, both in terms of what informs their own ideas, but also where they should be looking, and even things like, you know, where they should be looking for employment.
I mean, it's tricky in a way because in that framing, cosmopolitanism sounds great. You know, it sounds, you know, like exactly the kind of, I guess, set of attitudes and maybe orientation towards the world that, you know, that would be difficult to kind of critique. But one of the things you point out in the book is the way that actually this kind of cosmopolitan, I suppose, attitude doesn't play out exactly like that for the gappers. And, you know, it's really bound up with kind of some quite problematic judgments as well.
I mean, I suppose the thing is, and it's something that's kind of quite well established, is this idea that, well, first of all, that maybe the cosmopolitans are elite. So it's just kind of this idea of the elite traveller, a global elite traveller who has a privilege and the resources to be able to move freely from one place to place when other people are quite fixed. Another kind of way to come at that critique is just because you kind of consume difference, you consume these intercultural experiences, it doesn't necessarily mean that you learn anything or you become more open. So, and actually by kind of consuming that exoticness or authenticity, you're actually reproducing divisions. So, yeah, this idea of kind of elitism and kind of distinction and commercialization, I suppose, that kind of critique of cosmopolitanism comes from. So it's less about kind of the idea that cosmopolitanism is good or bad. It's more about what we're talking about, what kind of cosmopolitan experiences are people having.
And you sort of set this up by playing off, I think, two really important major theorists, I guess sort of Bourdieu, Pierre Bourdieu, who's a French social theorist, and Anthony Giddens, who's a sort of English social theorist. This manifests itself in the idea of two different forms of gapping, the kind of habitual and the reflexive gapper. So I wonder if you could sort of explain that that debate and possibly whose side you come down on.
Well, but the interesting, well, I suppose Giddens, first of all, is comes very much from this idea that to perhaps to be cosmopolitan, you need to be reflexive. So you need to kind of reflect back on yourself and think about, in terms of cosmopolitanism, especially, you know, your place in the world. So it's not just kind of being a global person and kind of going about kind of the day to day. It's actually kind of critically reflecting back on what that means. And also in terms of the way gap years are held up as this self-development activity. So it's, Giddens talks a lot about how young people at fateful moments, like, for example, you know, finishing school, they need to think about where they're going to go in their lives. They need to kind of tell the story of their lives in particular ways. And a lot of people refer to Giddens as trying to think about how young people use travel as a way of telling kind of who they are as people and that kind of process of reflexive self-development. So that's where the interest in Giddens comes on, especially when we're thinking about this is obviously all in the context of kind of increased global mobility and globalisation. In terms of Bourdieu, I mean, the project initially started very much focusing on Bourdieu's concept of cultural capital. So this idea that a gap year would be something for young people that was very advantageous, that they could use that when they were at university, they could use that when they were applying for jobs. And incidentally, I mean, that's kind of one of the ideas from this book came from, is that when I came back from travelling, I was applying just for temping jobs, you know, and I was kind of to go through all these recruitment consultants, and I had this gap in my CV, this 9-month gap in my CV, which is the period I've been travelling. So I wrote a little blurb about how it made me really independent and kind of all the things that doing that gave me, and the recruitment consultant told me that was brilliant. So that was really the idea, that this kind of travel, this self-development might actually be advantageous, and using Bourdieu's concept of cultural capital to understand that. And hand in hand with Bourdieu's concept of capital is this idea of habitus, that we are not reflexive about our actions. We have our kind of place in the world is kind of shapes us at this kind of pre-reflexive level. So it was, when I was thinking about how to approach this theoretically, it was very much setting up Bourdieu and Giddens in this opposition, which a lot of people do, and it's not necessarily kind of the most theoretically sophisticated way of doing it, but it was seeing, on one hand, you have a reflexive young person who is choosing the path through the world and deciding to go on a gap year because that is how they want to tell the story of their life and to develop themselves. And that also Giddens talks a lot about how the older kind of structures of class don't shape people's lives in the same way. Whereas from a Bourdieusian perspective, you get much more of this idea of the reproduction of social structures, and that young people might be more guided by the habitus. They this idea that a gap year is a kind of common sense good thing to do that will kind of help them to accumulate cultural capital, be advantageous for them in the future. And it's also those who in a position of privilege who kind of have a sense of knowing what's legitimate, and then they do the legitimate thing and they kind of get the legitimate outcome. So it's kind of setting up Giddens and Bourdieu at kind of opposite ends of a scale in terms of reflexivity on one hand and more habitual action on the other.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way you talk both about gap years as a means of accumulating this kind of cosmopolitan form of cultural capital that allows people to construct this cosmopolitan identity. But then in chapter 6, you have this kind of killer line that really stood out for me, that not everybody had the kind of the good taste to take a gap year, suggesting a really kind of important relationship between I suppose the idea that taking a gap year is a good thing, it's something mm-hmm. one should do, and it's a way of displaying the kind of, kind of good taste one mm-hmm. might have. And I wonder if you could say a bit about the relationship between that kind of idea of cosmopolitanism and consumption practices around having good taste mm-hmm. and maybe making social boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of a wider trend, and I think it's something that John Arus talked about as well. This idea of kind of realness and authenticity in good middle class taste. So, and the reason why boundaries come into it, it's quite often a lot easier to talk about what's bad taste, which tends to be stuff that's put against put in opposition to cosmopolitanism. So we know that bad taste is going to Malia or Ibiza and getting incredibly drunk and young people kind of having this very loud, ostentatious kind of experience that's all about getting drunk and hanging out with their friends and nothing to do with kind of engaging with local culture, whereas proper, nice middle-class travel is about, you know, real experience, going off the beaten track. And it's very much, this isn't necessarily kind of a new phenomenon. It's held up as tourists are quite often being seen as vulgar and unsophisticated, and it's really kind of drawing on that historical division between the tourist and the traveller. So tourists have go for inauthentic experiences, and they're kind of maybe concerned with pleasure, and it's things that are very easy. Whereas being a traveller is about, you know, getting inside a local culture, getting to understand kind of the local context, but also being able to move between different contexts as well. And that very much chimes with these trends towards cosmopolitanism as good taste. So you can get other examples of being able to go to lots of different types of restaurants. So being able to eat lots of different types of food is good cosmopolitan taste. So yeah, it's really kind of picking up on these trends, which are always kind of presented or tend to be presented as kind of very common sense. Well, you know, of course that's the best way to be. And what it does is it draws these boundaries between what is not seen as good taste, and that's always pretty much a very kind of classed boundary as well.
Yeah, I mean, it has so many obvious parallels with cultural consumption and the debates over omnivorousness in both the United States mm-hmm. And in Europe, where, you know, you see the idea of being able to not just kind of consume elite forms of culture, such as classical music mm-hmm. or complex conceptual art, but the ability to go between different cultural forms and different cultural worlds mm-hmm. is seen as a kind of, you know, a morally good thing. And it just so happens that it tends to be sections of the middle class, or the kind of the aspirational middle class and upper class, that have these attitudes, have this kind of omnivorous behavior and omnivorous tastes, and mm-hmm. yet it's maybe members of the working class or particular forms of socially mobile groups that don't have those tastes, and thus can be kind of made lesser or sort of have social distinction imposed upon mm-hmm. them. And it's fascinating to see your analysis, I guess, kind of reveal this depth, moving away from just saying, oh, only posh people take gap years or something like that, but to see mm-hmm. the kind of the function of this form of, as you say, travel rather than tourism. Mm-hmm. I guess kind of one thing that comes up in the book that allows you to make these kind of theoretically informed, detailed conclusions and comments is the aspect of the empirical research that connects up to the critical theory that you were working on. And in that respect, the book was quite innovative and involved, I guess, a kind of a new form of research that's emerging and becoming very popular in social science, which is doing online work. So what was the online aspect of the empirical work in the book?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that really ended up being the main kind of source of data, which was looking at the travel blogs that young people are doing about their gap years. is a kind of way of accessing the narratives, the stories that that young people told. And one of the main advantage of that is that it's the stories that they tell. It's not directed by a researcher, so it's kind of found narratives. So these are kind of the stories that young people present to the world, to whoever's reading their blog, about what a gap year involves, how they understand it. And one of the kind of ideas I use throughout the book is this idea of framing. So we kind of know a little bit about how gap years are framed in the media, you know, or in kind of public debates. And I was kind of quite interested to see how young people use those frames in their own kind of storytelling as well. So that's probably the blogs were really the main data source for the book. I did supplement them with some semi-structured interviews as well with some of the bloggers, but really it was the online stories, which is really kind of a new form of documentary, document analysis, really.
Yeah, I mean, it goes even beyond. I guess this will be familiar with British sociology listeners, but maybe not to other global audiences. It goes beyond the British tradition of something like a mass observation diary that is asking people to kind of, you know, keep diaries and stuff like that, in a sense that mm-hmm. the blogs are written by the individuals, not for research purposes, but I was going to say they're written for themselves, but actually one of the things that's really interesting is who they are written for and what the purpose mm-hmm. of the writing is, which is one of the major chapters in the book. So perhaps you could expand a bit on sort of who or what they're telling stories for.
Yeah, it's difficult, and I think that I probably could have written a whole book about the process of telling the kind of more methodological aspects and the storytelling aspects of this, because I think there was quite a lot of variation. But in general, blogs are a way of people kind of keeping their own record of their stories. So and also it's a way of communicating to other people as well. So there's lots of different elements. I mean, it was something that I was able to explore in the interviews with the gappers and that I spoke to, and they saw it as a way of, you know, keeping people up to date about their progress. But it was very much there's very much an awareness of who might be reading and kind of what the audience might be. So, I remember one guy I spoke to had something a bit more private on Facebook for his close friends, and his blog was very much kind of the public presentation of his experiences. Yeah, definitely. So there was a sense of this is almost kind of their official story about the gap year and what they were getting up to. And consequently, it's almost about the kind of the stories that should be told about gap years. So it might not necessarily be I'm not really bothered whether this is an accurate record of what happened. It's more about if they're telling stories to their friends, their parents, people who might have sponsored them to do their volunteering placements. You know, this is kind of the official version. This is me kind of using my time wisely and doing something worthwhile.
And the irony, of course, is that you try and pin this down in a chapter that tries to explore the idea of authenticity in the, mm-hmm. even as these, I suppose, kind of presentations of the self are occurring. They're occurring bound up with the idea of having authentic experiences as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that they're also bound up, which is the third of the empirical chapters, with the idea of being kind of self-developing or almost sort of, I guess, not entrepreneurial, but, you know, kind of people who are doing identity work, as you call it. And I wonder if you could give some examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps not entrepreneurial, but definitely kind of enterprising. And there's a definite kind of resonance with the, one of the things that interested me most about the gap year was that young people, when they're kind of told about what gap years involve, you know, it makes you more self-reliant, makes you independent, you become more confident. who kind of they're told about these kind of qualities, which are quite kind of enterprising. There's a particular type of personality associated with that that's also associated with doing well in kind of professional careers, basically. So they kind of get these ideas about what a gap year will give you, and then you think, when they kind of reflect on that, it's almost that idea is reproduced. Like, oh yes, well, I went on a gap year and I became more independent and self-reliant and I became more confident and I grew as a person. And that's kind of associated with the practice of doing a gap year.
Yeah, it's that, as you call it, the kind of habitual approach to the gap year, rather than, I guess, as some of the more optimistic writers about cosmopolitanism and modernity would say, would be the kind of the reflexive approach. It's that thing, I guess, of, you know, everybody seems like they're an individual in these blogs, but when you look at them all together, there seems to be very clear social structures kind of behind them.
Yeah, I mean, it always reminds me of that scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian when everybody says, "Oh yes, we're all individuals." Yeah. And I think it's and you can see it not just in kind of their stories of self-development, but in, you know, everybody, all of the bloggers who go to this particular island in Australia tell you the same story about what's happening to this particular lake, because they all go on the same tours.
Yeah.
And they can all, so they all get the same information and they can present that. And it's funny because I did some of the similar things to some of these young people are doing, and I kind of already, that's the kind of information that I had about these places. So that idea that they're being exposed to the world in a particular way, and they're learning about the world, they're learning very particular things about the world. And the thing that I found most, it's kind of almost a problem when it gets very pessimistic, is the idea that it's kind of pointless. And what I tried to do was take it a little bit further and think about, well, when do you get these points of critical reflection? When do you actually get this idea that it's not just, it's kind of very, depressing, this idea is, and where you get it from is when they kind of get some resistance to the ideas or some kind of dialogue or pushback. So that's kind of some of the theoretical conclusions I try to draw about how to resolve this kind of dichotomy between the habitual and the reflexive.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because you sort of extend, I suppose, Bourdieu a little bit in the book. You talk about the way that Bourdieu saw reflexivity occurring in kind of moments of crisis, or I suppose our modern language would be the kind of, you know, the moments of cognitive dissonance or something like that. Whereas actually, you know, you talk about the gappers having great times, you know, sort of really enjoying their year, and moments of crisis not really being quite the right term.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the things I thought of was maybe being out of place might provide that. And what was kind of interesting is that when they talk about being out of place, you know, literally like maybe physically out of place and not physically fitting in with the people around them, they were actually talking about those physical differences in kind of quite non-cosmopolitan ways.
Yeah.
So kind of drawing on stereotypes about the people that were surrounding them.
The sort of reemergence of the discourses of, you know, from which they were trying to distance themselves and kind of show that they had the good taste not to, you know, be, I guess, either tourists or kind of colonial travellers.
Mm-hmm.
I've got kind of two, I guess, kind of broader questions about the conclusion to the book, in the way that, from my sense, and you can maybe disagree with me, was that you're sort of ambivalent about cosmopolitanism in a sense that it kind of comes across in the text as being just another form of middle-class capital, just another way of kind of, I guess, the middle class reinforcing their already existing social position. And in the kind of Bourdieuian sense, they're kind of replicating their social power. So I wonder, I mean, is that the right reading? I mean, and what do we do if, you know, the kind of the ideas that a lot of us on the, I guess, kind of, you know, liberal end of society and politics are actually kind of, you know, bound up with power and control?
I mean, I think my it sounds terrible saying you have a problem with cosmopolitanism. I think I have a problem with who gets to be cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
And that's really where it comes from. So there's a lot of really valuable work about alternative cosmopolitans and subaltern cosmopolitans and ordinary cosmopolitanism. That I think is really important, and I think it's this idea of framing as well. So it's not the fact that this isn't a cosmopolitan experience. It's that this is held up as the kind of, I think probably the way to be cosmopolitan. So there's a really interesting article by a guy called Kremin, who I draw upon, who says, well, you know, young person going in a gap year is seen to be cosmopolitan. A young person who maybe runs away from home and kind of supports themselves and maybe moves to a big city, it's not seen as, that's not a cosmopolitan experience, even though they're kind of doing, the things that they're getting out of them are probably kind of inherently quite similar. So it's back to this idea of framing. And I think one of the things I struggled with a little bit was that you could say, oh, well, how do we make young people who take gap years to be more cosmopolitan? How do we get them to kind of critically reflect a bit more on their kind of place in the world? And I think that's probably quite important. But the danger of that is that it's kind of, again, focusing on, it's focusing on the kind of already privileged group and helping them to become kind of more, to kind of improve their experiences, rather than addressing kind of some of these bigger issues about what does and doesn't have value and what is and isn't legitimate.
Which I guess ultimately is the kind of the purpose of sociology. So, I mean, that's a sort of fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed the book, and, you know, I sort of do recommend it to anyone who's interested, not just in the kind of sociological aspects of class and culture, but also, you know, a much wider audience that, you know, might be interested in kind of, you know, travel and what traveling means and this sort mm-hmm. of thing. Just to sort of finish off, it'd be really interesting to know what you're doing sort of now in terms of your work, where the work is going, because obviously there's a whole bunch of questions that come up in the book about, you know, youth transitions to adulthood, questions of culture, mm-hmm. class, taste and value. And I'm just interested to know, sort of, is there another version of the book in the works, or are you doing something completely different?
It's slightly different. I mean, I will say that it's probably ruined, doing this research has kind of ruined travel a little bit for me.
Also, to kind of consume culture now after being a cultural sociologist.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's that idea of, you know, kind of when you go on holiday and can you really, you know, kind of reading guidebooks and getting to know the inside and thinking, oh, well, none of us can do that. And I'm just kind of reproducing middle-class values if I try to do that. So, it does make you think a lot about, does make you think a lot about kind of your own place in the world doing this sort of work. I've been working quite a lot with Professor Fiona Devine, who is also at the University of Manchester, and we've been doing some work on young people's kind of hopes and dreams for the future in terms of their transitions to employment. And I've also been working, I've also recently joined the Great British Class Survey team, which has had a lot of interest recently. And it's kind of a very big project. It's looking at kind of more Jerseyan understandings of class and how we might be able to use that to understand the UK. And what I've been particularly focusing on is perhaps some more qualitative follow-up work on that, and also kind of the subjectivities around class. So back to some of these ideas about boundary drawing and kind of legitimate cultural value, and also more kind of broad ideas about legitimacy and value as well. So that's the main two things I've been working on recently, and I'm hoping to develop these a little bit further and to really kind of focus on, go back to kind of some interests I have in the sociology of youth and the perceived choices that young people have and the kind of structural constraints that they encounter.
That sounds brilliant, and hopefully you'll do another new book on it, and we can get you back on the podcast soon. So thanks very much, Helen. And
thank you.
I recommend that everybody takes a look at the new book. Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University of London. We were talking with Helen Snee from the University of Manchester about her book, A Cosmopolitan Journey, Difference, Distinction and Identity Work in Gap Year Travel. It's out with Ashgate at the moment. And as you will have heard from the podcast, I really recommend that a broad audience engages with it. It's a really interesting text. Hopefully we'll see you next time for another New Books in Critical Theory podcast.